Good morning, everyone. I'm calling the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. We have a busy day today. We have three bills that we're going to try to take public testimony on, and the chair just wants to make certain everyone understands. The purpose of today's hearings is just that, taking public testimony. We have no intention of attempting to move any of the three bills out today through a work session because there's some work that still needs to be done. With that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 311. And first of all, I'm going to ask counsel if you want to give us a brief overview, and then we're going to bring up the co-chair of the task force.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 311 is the bill that raises the caps for the Oregon Tort Claims Act. It's a result of the Oregon Tort Claims Task Force that was convened last spring by the 2008 legislature. And we have our former co-chair of the task force, Representative McPherson, former Representative McPherson, here to talk about what the task force did.
Great.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Greg McPherson, former state representative for House District 38 and former co-chair, along with Chair Przanski, of the task force that was assigned to develop a solution for the issues surrounding Oregon's Tort Claims Act in the last interim. I know that there are members of this committee who are also members that sat through the elaborate presentations, in fact, like a majority of this committee. But for the benefit of those two who were not members of the task force, I will give the background and history of what we were undertaking to do and what we came up with. The task force was appointed as a result of the holding in the Clark decision, Clark v. OHSU, that Oregon's Tort Claims Act, which limits the recovery against public entities, was unconstitutional in violation of Oregon's Remedies Clause as applied to the particular facts of that case. It was a medical error case involving alleged damages over $10 million in losses as future medical expenses for the child who was the injured party. And that was as compared to a cap under Oregon's Tort Claims Act of $200,000, which under current law is $100,000 of economic damages and $100,000 of non-economic damages for a total recovery of $200,000. And the holding in that case was that the remedies clause of Oregon's Constitution, that was in violation because it did not provide a substantial alternative remedy for the injured party. That really put our whole climate of tort claims recoveries into doubt in Oregon because it means that on a case-by-case basis, any particular case could be held to be, or injury could be held to be outside of the limits of the Tort Claims Act and cause then potential recoveries against public entities, including the state, but also local governments, that would far exceed that $200,000 limit. And because of that uncertainty and the need to review where the Tort Claims Act stands, the task force was appointed by the leadership of the House and the Senate in the last interim. It consisted of five members of the House, five members of the Senate, and several members of the public. And there are some of the stakeholder groups were represented with respect to this issue on that task force, and some of them are here today and can speak about the result of the task force. What the task force developed is a three-part recommendation and in what I think is a model of brevity for work of the Oregon legislature. The report of the Tort Claims Act is on two pages. And I haven't made copies of those, but I assume that you those have been furnished to you.
That's regular print. That's like a 10-point, not 6-point, correct?
That's right. No reason to belabor with too much paper. And those recommendations have now been reflected in the three bills that are posted for today, Senate Bills 311, 305, and 302. The main issue is addressed in Senate Bill 311, which recommends an increase in the cap amounts for personal injury claims and for property claims, which has a feature of having a two-tier set of caps. That is, there is one set of caps for the state government, including OHSU, which would move upon passage of this legislation an effective date of 7/1/09 to $1.5 million per claim. So, in other words, a 7.5-fold increase from the $200,000 cap that applies today. That's per claimant. And then twice that amount per occurrence. So if there were an event that caused damages to or injuries to multiple parties, the total amount that would be to be recovered would be capped at that $3 million amount, twice the $1.5 million. And then there would be step increases in that $1.5 or $3 million per claim per occurrence set of caps over the next 5 years, stepping up to the point where they're at $2 million and $4 million, respectively. Now, the concern that was addressed by the task force was that this increase, which really only reflects the substantial increase in costs for medical expenses and the exposure that an institution like OHSU has, could cause a substantial increase in cost to other public entities. And so the solution recommended by the task force and reflected in Senate Bill 311 is a two-tier system where local government entities are at one-third of that amount. So the relationship is 3-1 between the exposure of the state and the exposure of local government entities. And so it would move immediately to $500,000 per claim, that is one-third of the $1.5 million cap for the state at July 1, 2009, and then would step up at one-third of the increments that are scheduled for the cap in state exposure. And while that split level of exposure is not maybe an ideal solution, it seemed like the best solution in an environment where we have the likelihood that anything significantly short of the $1.5 million, $3 million level could be struck down by the Oregon Supreme Court as not being an adequate remedy in a medical malpractice claim. Then balances that with the need for economy for our local governments who are facing generally claims that are not in the medical malpractice area. There were two other ideas that came out of the recommendations of the task force, which are set out in these separate bills, in Senate Bill 305 and Senate Bill 302, and they're to deal with I would characterize them as ancillary issues, not central issues to the work of the task force. One of those, which is under the heading, and it's the summary called indemnity issues, deals with the contracting relationship between a public entity and a private contractor. And there had been some doubt cast on the question of whether by court decisions, whether the exposure of a public entity that contracts with a private party could be shifted by contract to the private party and the private party's insurer. And the thrust of this decision or this recommendation is to make it clear that it is possible for a public entity to contract with a private party and agree that the private party would be responsible and its insurer responsible, with only a responsibility on the part of the public entity up to the Tort Claims Act limits if there were not an effective recovery against an insurer or a solvent party. And then the third proposal is under the heading in our report, State Contracting with Local Government, we recognize that when you have this two-tier level of liability, there will be a question in some areas of cooperative activity between the state and a local government as to which cap level applies. And the thrust of this recommendation is to provide that the state can't avoid the larger exposure under the state limits by passing off a responsibility that belongs to the state to a local government, so that it would be the state caps that apply when that occurs. As I said, these two other issues were set out in separate bills because they're really ancillary to the overall issues, and the main thrust of the work of the task force is reflected in Senate Bill 311. So with that introduction, and I know there will be others here to speak in more detail about some or all aspects of this, that is an introduction, and I will entertain any questions you might have.
Question and back over to Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. Just so that I understand the history here, I mean, this appears, and I'm not a lawyer, as you know. I'm like, I guess two of us are lawyers here. So
by the time we get finished the session.
I'm hoping not, Mr. Chair. three, I guess. So I understand this. I mean, and I'm looking for a little historical perspective because you were here. We served in the House together, and you've been here a lot longer. Right? We have one class of individuals over here, which is state government, local government, cities, all of that, so on and so forth. And as this is a medical malpractice issue, is how what started this whole ball rolling in the court case. The other class of people are the public medical facilities, nonprofit medical facilities, and profit medical facilities. Historically, I mean, obviously, we're addressing right here just the public entities, but I mean, there's this other tier. So, how do we get to where we are now, where we're treating one class, which is the public medical facilities, in a different sort of way as private? So, why don't we address nonprofit and profit, I guess, in this case? And are there really implications in this case that came out that address medical malpractice this way versus government this way?
Chair Przanski, Senator Boquist, the charge to our Tort Claims Task Force was to address the concerns relating to the Oregon Tort Claims Act, which applies to public entities. There's a broader debate about medical malpractice issues more generally. Those are not directly affected by the Oregon Tort Claims Act, and really are only affected when the services in question are being delivered by a public entity. And that happens in a relatively few institutions within the state, OHSU being the principal one. There are some local government hospitals and clinics, but that's a relatively minor part of what local government delivers. The recommendations of the task force did not address the broader debate about medical malpractice issues.
And if I can, Senator, the other part to your question, the Oregon Tort Claims Act was actually adopted by the legislature in 1967, so it's been in existence for over 40 years. And so basically what we're addressing is the call it the fallout of the decision that came out of the Supreme Court regarding a particular case that was under the Tort Claims Act.
And Mr. Chair, that was the subject of my question, because I don't know the details of the case. Was the case premise that it's medical malpractice regardless of who it is, or was it an issue of public entities being treated differently? That's what I was trying to figure out.
Chair Przanski, Senator Boquist, the policy of treating public entities different from other entities with respect to tort liability is a long-standing policy in the state of Oregon and in many other states. And the recommendations of the task force don't change that policy. What they do is they update the cap amounts that have been in place for and unchanged for over 20 years in Oregon, and just a pure general inflation adjustment would have more than doubled the Tort Claims Act limits that were in current law. But the sort of the overriding reality here is that medical costs have inflated much faster than general inflation, so that the adequacy of the remedy that was available to people 20 years ago under a $200,000 cap has been just blown out of the water by medical inflation, so that when you look at a
$200,000 recovery for somebody with lifetime medical care. It just it doesn't work.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Mr. McPherson, would you discuss in some detail the effects of the removal of the distinction between economic and non-economic damages by the repeal of ORS 30.270, and with specific emphasis on how the changes actually alter how the complaint would be handled by the court in one package instead of as in two, as I understand, and on the practical result in potentially creating the desire for the defendant to settle out of court rather than to face the bundled economic non-economic damage?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt, I'll address it at least as an initial matter, but I will defer to others who are going to be speaking who have more technical knowledge. I should say about my own background, while I am a practicing lawyer, personal injury law is not something I've ever handled in my professional practice. And so just how one would bring a case claim for injury forward under the Tort Claims Act is not something that I have professional knowledge of. But you identify a significant aspect of our recommendation, which I did not mention in my opening remarks, which is that the existing Tort Claims Act has a distinction between economic and non-economic damages. As I mentioned, there is a $100,000 limit on economic damages and a separate $100,000 limit on non-economic damages to total $200,000. The recommendation for the task force is to eliminate that distinction. Now, the key driver here is the increase in medical costs and the reality that to provide lifetime medical care, as is often an issue in serious medical error cases, those are economic damages and they will dwarf any other category of damage. But as a matter of simplifying the process of litigation and avoiding a distinction that is thorny in its own way between economic and non-economic damages, part of the recommendation is to eliminate that so that up to the $1.5 million and $3 million new caps, a claimant could present their case with either category of damage.
Any other questions?
Representative McPherson. Greg, thank you very much for coming down and giving the framework of the task force. At this point, I'm going to call a panel up of people that were, instrumental in putting the package together that's before us, and that's going to be Mr. Blair, Mr. Lane, and Mr. Statham. Gentlemen, I'm going to let you all start off. Maybe it, just as kind of as a framework, Mr. Lane and Mr. Statham, since y'all started the, let's say, discussions outside of the task force, maybe kind of giving the committee a little bit of background of how that worked, and then we can bring in Mr. Blair as to how it evolved into working the two-tier system.
Good morning, members of the committee, Chair Brzezinski. My name is Steve Statham, Executive Vice President of Oregon Health and Science University. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. To respond to Chair Brzezinski's question, Mr. Lane and I and other representatives of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and OHSU met several times during the summer of 2008. Just prior to the really the first and second meetings of the Tort Claims Act Task Force, of which we were members, at the suggestion of the governor's staff and legislative leadership, not Chair Brzezinski or then Representative McPherson, but as a suggestion, as two of the stakeholders who might be able to come up with some proposed solutions to then bring forth to the task force. We ended up spending about four meetings together and ultimately involved federal judge Gar King to help basically act as a facilitator or mediator to try to bridged the parties' differences or perspectives and ultimately came up with a recommendation for a new Tort Claims Act limit. That was the limit that former Representative McPherson described in his remarks, except that it would have been applicable to all public entities. It was the increase to $1.5 million per claim and $3 million for per occurrence for multiple claimants. And we then reported that to the co-chairs of the task force and other members of the task force. That was approximately mid-September. And so that was the history of the discussions that occurred between the trial lawyers and OHSU.
Great, thank you.
Someone
add anything?
I think that's good enough for the framework. Why don't you go ahead and give our the presentation that you
okay. Thank you. I guess start first, and then Mr. Blair, Mr. Lane. First of all, OHSU believes it is essential that a limitation on liability be in place for public bodies, and that any new tort cap solution must strike a fair balance between ensuring that adequate resources are available to Oregonians who need public services and compensating injured claimants. We do believe the current $200,000 cap, which was ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, is too low and should be raised. We've testified to that in the past and continue to believe that. We also believe that any new tort cap proposal should apply to all claims against all public bodies, regardless of the type of service provider or the cause of injury. As we've said before, a child who suffers brain damage from child abuse inflicted in a negligent foster care placement should have rights of recovery equivalent to a child who suffers brain damage in a school bus accident or in a neurosurgery procedure. The 2007 Supreme Court decision that effectively eliminated the tort cap was a major setback for public services throughout Oregon. Public resources that were historically used to pay for public services had to be used to pay for liability coverage. The court ruling was much larger than OHSU or just medical malpractice. It affected all public entities in Oregon and all kinds of public services. Specifically, it meant that all public entities immediately moved into an uncapped or potentially uncapped environment. A single mistake could imperil a public agency. One large judgment could potentially bankrupt a small community. For OHSU in particular, the impact was immediate. In February of 2008, as a result of higher insurance costs and the need for additional liability reserves, we had no choice but to cut $20 million per year out of our budget. We are currently estimating that if the Oregon Tort Cap Task Force's proposal is adopted, the university could save approximately $12.5 million per year in insurance and reserve costs. Given the current economic climate that we're all in, this relief would help OHSU's current deficit significantly. Senate Bill 311 represents the thoughtful work of the Interim Tort Cap Task Force, which was charged with crafting recommendations for the 2009 legislature. After studying the issues related to the Oregon Tort Claims Act, the task force recommended new tort cap limits for state and local government entities. The task force proposal represents the efforts of participants from the state, local governments, OHSU, and the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. This recommendation increases the likelihood that the injured party is more fully compensated for his or her injuries, protects the constitutional right identified in Clark in most cases, and allows governmental entities to maintain an appropriate amount of insurance in case of future claims. Thank you.
Okay. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm Bill Blair. I'm Senior Assistant County Counsel in Washington County. And for the last 30-some years, close to 40, I have been primarily engaged in defense of either the city of Salem when I worked there or Washington County now in claims under the Oregon Tort Claims Act. It was my privilege during the interim to serve on the interim task force. And you have some written comments before you. I'm not going to take the time to read through all of them. There are some high points I think that I would like to emphasize. One which is not made in the written comments that you have, but I think is important by way of background in understanding the Clark versus OHSU case and its impact not only on OHSU itself, but on state and local government. actually twofold. The first thing that is important to understand is that the Oregon Supreme Court specifically upheld the existing limits of the Oregon Tort Claims Act as they apply to the state and to other public bodies within the state. Those limits are constitutional. It is a facet of the Oregon Tort Claims Act that the legislature, with the complete support of the state and local public bodies as employers, that the act requires a public employer to indemnify and defend its employees when they are sued as a result of something that they did in the course and scope of their official duties. So in other words, if I am driving home today and I have a traffic accident, Washington County, as my employer, would be vicariously liable for my negligence resulting in that accident. But also, I don't stop being a human being and I don't stop having been negligent, and so I may be sued as well. What the Oregon Tort Claims Act says is if you're going to be suing a public employee or officer as a result of something that happens in the course and scope of their official duties, the plaintiff has a substitute remedy. And that substitute remedy is not to go against Bill Blair and whatever is his equity after the mortgage is satisfied, but rather to go directly and solely against Washington County. The part of Clark that has created, therefore, the issue is not the suit against Washington County, but rather the suit naming Bill Blair as an individual, because back in 1857, when the Oregon Constitution was drafted, Bill Blair could just as well have been sued individually, as well as Washington County, the employer. So the plaintiff would have a remedy against me. It is the cap as applied under the facts of a particular case, not generally, but as applied to the facts in a particular case, that may be unconstitutional if it deprives the plaintiff of a substantial remedy against me, the Bill Blair individual. The way it affects state and local government, then, is because they're obligated to pay whatever it is that the jury or the settlement says I have to pay because of my own negligence. The distinction, and I'm pleased that Mr. Statham raised it, the distinction between the claim against state and local, or against a local government, versus the claim against OHSU or the state of Oregon, is not based on the plaintiff who's injured. It's based on the nature of the entity that's being sued and has to pay. Because ultimately, it's going to be the taxpayers of the state of Oregon with respect to claims against the state, or the taxpayers of Washington County with the claim against Washington County, that are going to bear the cost, the total cost, overall cost, annually budgeted, of the risk that we face. We try and defer that by buying insurance. Most Oregon cities and counties are either self-insured, as is Washington County, or they have insurance, and I'll put quotes around insurance, through an entity known as City County Insurance Services that was created back in the 1970s when the insurance market really tightened up, as we're expecting it's likely to do now, and has resulted now in a pooled self-insurance of cities and counties. There is a corresponding entity that has fairly recently been organized through the Special Districts Association of Oregon and Oregon School Boards Association. But the purpose of those insurance entities is to provide a source for managing the risk of state and of local governments, districts, cities, counties, school boards. The $12 million that OHSU may save, or the $18 million that OHSU some time back when Clark was first announced and the fallout became known, that the $12 million may be absorbed by OHSU because they have a simple economy of scale that makes it possible for them to absorb those kinds of costs. But a $12 million increase can't be absorbed by Milton Freewater. It can't be absorbed by Harney County. It can't be absorbed by a rural school district. It really can't even be absorbed by those entities that are created to provide a pooled self-insurance for local governments. And the result is that we look at ourselves as cities, counties, districts, and school boards and say, raising caps to the extent that the state and Oregon Health and Sciences University can afford is going to mean we're not going to get a lot of jobs done. The kind of jobs that we're not going to get done are going to be the ones that are not the fat, they're the meat and the bones of the services we provide as local government. What we did then was go back and try and get a handle on how much it was going to cost. And it'll be a cost, a substantial cost, estimates in the neighborhood of 14% of an increase in the total cost of risk for any individual entity to raise the caps from the existing $200,000 to the proposed $500,000 per claimant. That is a cost that is going to mean a lot of belt tightening, but it's something that state and local or that local governments, including the city, county insurance services, and other entities that pool those risks, can afford. But going from that $500,000 to the $1.5 million that the are the limits that have been agreed on between the trial lawyers and OHSU means another 24% increase in our total cost of risk, and that we simply can't absorb.
And that, frankly, is the distinction between the plaintiff was injured in a traffic accident with a county van,
as opposed to the plaintiff that's injured or suffers brain damage because the breathing tube didn't get properly placed in a recovery room at OHSU. It's not that they are any less brain dead. It's not that they have any less damages. It is simply that the public cannot afford the cost of those risks at the local government level, the same way that it can at the state and an entity the size of OHSU. commenting on SB 311, there are some amendments, I believe, that have been proposed by the Special Districts Association of Oregon, and I certainly support those. I believe those are important, and they simply have to do with the definition of what a public body is. It is important, however, and Chair Brzezinski, if it's appropriate to comment briefly on Senate Bill 302 and 305 at the same time.
No. I'd like to keep them separate because we have other people who want to speak on 311. Let's do it that way, please.
I will have some comments on 302 and 305.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Mr. Lane, if you have some brief comments that you'd like to also share.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Richard Lane. I am also a member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and was one of the task force members. I'm not going to spend a lot of time. I think some of the background has been covered. I just would like to comment that Chair Brzezinski and Chair McPherson and all the members of the committee worked awful hard on the 311, which I think is the meat and potatoes of the task force recommendations. As Mr. Statham explained, there were some informal discussions that took place. Ultimately, we did spend some time with Federal Judge Gar King, but there were also some meetings with some of the other organizations and stakeholders, and there was an awful lot of meetings in front of the task force, and an awful lot of people had input, and I think Chair Przanski and Chair McPherson did a heck of a job in trying to distill down on two pieces of paper the essence of the recommendations of the task force. On 311, there are a couple of observations that I have. Senator Whitsitt has pointed out the one of the cornerstones of the recommendation was the elimination of the economic, non-economic damage distinction. And in Section 2 of Senate Bill 311, there's a provision that in practical application reinstates that damage distinction. And we feel that's not part of the recommendation. It should be eliminated. Another one of the recommendations was, I think it's Section 6, the direct appeal recommendation. And there was a desire on some of the governmental entities that there be a mechanism in place to pursue a direct appeal to the Supreme Court to further test the constitutionality of the new limits as recommended in the proposal. In essence, a second Clark case if the facts arose that justified taking it to the Supreme Court for review. The proposal that's in there, it sets up a potential malpractice trap because it has a dual-track system for appellate review, one taking the direct route, but the other proceeding in the normal course, if you had other appellate issues to present to a court of appeals, we just like that streamline that either all appellate issues are stayed pending resolution of the direct review on the single constitutional issue, or permitting all issues to go up in the regular course through the regular appellate process. And I think those things could be worked out in drafting. We'd bring something at a later date. I think that's all I would say on 311 and just move along.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Co-Chair McPherson suggested he wasn't qualified or practiced in the answering the question that I asked, and I would like to ask that of you as well. If you would discuss in some detail the effects of the removal of the distinction between economic and non-economic damages by repealing ORS 3270, and specifically on how the changes actually alter how the complaint would be structured and how that complaint would be handled by the court during the trial proceedings, and also on the your opinion of what practical result in the creating the desire for the defendant to settle out of court rather than to face the bundled charges of the bundled claim of a economic and non-economic damages together.
Sure. Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsitt, I'll try to walk right through the, but if I omit one, please get back to me,
sure,
okay? That series of questions sort of dovetails with something Senator Boquist raised, and that is the treatment between the private versus the public. So I'm going to start by explaining that in a case against an individual, typically the person comes in, you obtain all the medical records, you speak with the people, you retain experts if it's a medical negligence case, even if it's an auto case, perhaps an accident reconstructionist, develop your facts associated with the case, establish your liability, and determine the damages that the individual has suffered. If it's a death case, it raises certain questions. If it's an injury case, it raises certain questions. If the people are married, if they have children, all of these are questions that need to be answered pre-filing. At the time the complaint is filed, then, you're in a position to state in the complaint that's filed the nature of the allegations brought against certain defendants and the negligence allegations that are asserted against an individual defendant or multiple defendants if it's that type of a case. Towards the end of the complaint, there are a series of requirements that you plead out for the court the various damages associated with the claim. It would be at that point that you would look at perhaps past medical expenses, the future medical expenses, past wage loss, perhaps a future impairment of earning capacity. If you have a wife that has been injured, is there a loss of services? These are all economic damages as defined in 31.710. They are objective, verifiable numbers, and those should be set out and pled inside the complaint. Then there is what is called the non-economic damage. It is also defined in 31.710, and it is the other types of intangibles that everybody intuitively realizes that has been damaged or a loss has been suffered, although they may not be objective and verifiable, but we define them as the loss of society and companionship, the pain and suffering that an individual has gone through, perhaps as an emotional component, given the nature of the injury, perhaps as an embarrassment or some sort of emotional trauma associated with a scarring or a disfigurement. And the nature of the age of the individual is going to dictate to a certain degree both the economic and non-economic component. So all of that is gathered together. It's put into the complaint. The complaint is filed, and the defendant has the opportunity to pursue during discovery all of the various allegations in there. So there's a request for wages, medical expenses, so on and so forth. And the parties typically get a good handle on the damages associated with any individual case as part of the discovery process. You've had a chance to take a deposition of the plaintiff or the family members. You find out a little bit about that individual. So on around some point in the litigation, but in advance of the trial, all parties have come to understand the nature of the injury and the damage and the loss that has been suffered, and then go through a process of trying to quantify that and then factor in what is the particular liability aspect, the negligence allegations. Some cases, they scream out that there's no defense. Others, maybe not. And that factors into whether there's a desire to resolve the case. And if the parties are interested in trying to resolve the case, then they oftentimes engage either a judge, or there are private, I don't want to say older, but more seasoned members of the Oregon State Bar that provide services as mediators. They are retired judges that work as mediators. And there's an opportunity for the parties to go see the mediator and see if they can come to an agreement as to a resolution of the case. If that proves to be not workable, then all of the evidence is put in front of a jury, and a jury returns a verdict based upon all of the evidence that they hear from both sides in the case. So that's the framework, I guess, of how the complaint comes to be, what's in it, and how it is resolved, and how the parties handle the case once it's been filed. And that's the private sector. So the public sector has always had this non-economic distinction inside of the Oregon Tort Claims Act. And as Chair Brzezinski mentioned, or Chair McPherson, I should say, mentioned, that's a $100,000 cap under existing law. If, and only if, you can prove that you have suffered economic damages, medical expenses, wage loss, in excess of $100,000, that first layer, then you can access a second layer that's designed to afford another $100,000, but only for economic loss. So, given the Clark decision and the fact that the cap as to individual employees, agents, and officers of a governmental body, that was found unconstitutional, the cap in existence, the elimination of the distinction became important. And what this bill, if passed, will do in the elimination of that is place the individual in public service on the same footing as the individual that's operating in private service. I think that's all of them, but if there was one I missed, Senator Whitsitt, I'd be happy to give it a shot.
Yes. In the public sector, would this, the result of passing this act, change how you structure the complaint? And will it change how the court actually handles the complaint, as in one part as it, or rather than two parts, and will it change how the jury is resolves those charges on, as first looking at economic and then looking at non-economic damages? I mean, discuss that. That's the nuts and bolts I'm looking at.
Chair Pazinski, Senator Whitson, I'll take a stab at it. I don't think it makes a change in how it's either worked up or presented to a jury. And I say that because for a number of years leading up to the Clark decision, the exact thing that would be taking place after the amendment is made, eliminating the distinction, has already been taking place. In order to preserve the constitutional challenge that was ultimately met head-on by the Oregon Supreme Court in Clark, all of the cases that involve governmental bodies have always pled and proved, or attempted to prove, either by stipulated facts or if you could get a judge to allow the jury to return a verdict and then handle a reduction to the cap after the verdict, they're always being prepared this way, and the full damage that is suffered, both the economic and non-economic, is being generated right now even without the elimination as proposed in 311. So I don't think there's any practical change, and I think that the court, in any review of a change in the cap limitations, is going to be looking for that differential, because it gives you an understanding of whether whatever number you decide to set as a legislative body, whether that's a substantial remedy after the constitutional analysis is applied to the loss in any given case. So I don't think it's a change, and I think it's going to be done, and I think it's necessary for anybody to do that to preserve all the constitutional issues presented in a case.
Thank you for that response, and if I may, would Mr. Blair have anything to add to that answer?
Chair Pazinski, Senator Whitson, to us as defending these cases, in terms of the mechanics through trial, I think Mr. Lane is correct. The only change that may be made is that currently some judges will instruct the jury, your award of non-economic damages may not exceed $100,000. Others will simply wait until after the verdict comes in and then reduce the amount to meet the requirements of the Tort Claims Act. In terms of preparing our defense for presentation at trial, it will be the same, because the plaintiff will still have to plead and prove both the dollar cost, the fixed dollar cost of economic damages, and give the jury some guideline as to what they think, as plaintiff, ought to be awarded as non-economic damages. The difference that it makes to us in terms of defending the case is evaluating and coming to potential determination of settlement. When I started this business 35 years ago, you could the rule of thumb was you take the what in those days were called special damages, and you multiply by two, and that's the general damages or non-economic damages. The art of advocacy has become far more sophisticated than that over the last several decades. And now we have sophisticated tools to use to try and analyze or evaluate what the potential is for a jury verdict. It by removing the non-economic damage limit, it means that we have less certainty and less predictability in trying to decide how we're going to settle a case or make a decision to defend. Beyond that, I'm not sure how I can help you further. As you know, our initial preference coming in as local government was to keep a distinction between economic and non-economic damages. What we have analyzed and determined is we can manage and support the elimination of that distinction as long as the caps are maintained at the levels in the proposed legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Blair.
Thank you.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification, Mr. Lane, does anything in Senate Bill 311 regarding the removal of the distinction between economic and non-economic damages change the burden or what the plaintiff has to prove to recover those damages, the standard of proof?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici, members of the committee, no, there's no change whatsoever. In the standard of proof and what is required to be proved before a judge either allows a motion to strike for inadequacy or directs a verdict otherwise. So,
thank you.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Our next panel is going to include Paul Snyder, Haseem Squire, and is it Frank? I don't know if it's Shanton or Shanton. Oh, Stratton. Okay, thank you. The R threw me off because I couldn't read it. And I'll give you the choice of who's going to lead off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Snyder, and I represent the Association of Oregon Counties. I think the dialogue from the preceding panel has negated most of the need for my testimony. I would like to emphasize, however, the dialogue that occurred with respect to the issue of economic and non-economic damages as it relates to the perspective of local government. And that is to say, just to reiterate what Mr. Blair said just before that preceding panel left the dais, and that is from the perspective of local government, the caps that are set forth in Senate Bill 311 for local government is something that we can handle even if the distinction between economic and non-economic damages is removed. However, if those caps were raised, we would want to reopen the discussion as to the distinction between economic and non-economic damages. And the difference between the two, frankly, is that economic damages are more ascertainable, they're more quantifiable, they're more easily proven, and they're more definite and certain than non-economic damages are. And in a situation where tort claim caps increase, our perspective is that the settlement negotiations would take a different turn as a result of that. So simply stated, I think these economic and non-economic damage distinction is important, except that in the situation where we have in Senate Bill 311, as I understood the bill to be written or intended, at those liability limits, we can handle those things with not that great a reduction in the level of services that we provide.
Thank you.
Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Haseem Squires. I'm here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon and a nonprofit association that represents approximately 900 special districts throughout the state of Oregon. With me today is Frank Stratton, our insurance services director. I just want to echo our support or reiterate our support for the task force recommendations, but mainly speak to the Dash 1 amendment. It is our association that requested the amendment. The change comes on page 6 of Senate Bill 311. Lines 15 and 16, under the definition of public body, there's a whole host of things that are articulated there, state agency, city, county, special, or school district. Our piece of that comes in on lines 15 and 16, sub D, any nonprofit organization organized under Chapter ORS 65 that only has political subdivisions as members. Special Districts Association is one of those people. We're not the only people. The Oregon Fire District Directors Association is organized in that manner. Oregon Public Courts Association is organized in that manner. And the Oregon Public Utility, I could go on ad nauseum. We do not fit in this definition underneath. In line 18, a public body is defined in ORS 174. We went through a long rewrite, I think it was two or three sessions ago, with the Law Commission to try to include everything in that public body definition. This is one of those aberrations where we exist here and we need to continue to exist here. So our amendment simply puts back in what was already in place.
It's my understanding that was an oversight on the part when we were putting this bill together that we thought that the definition that's now for public body under ORS 174.109 actually included it, but Apparently it does not, and so that's why we have the dash ones.
Senator Pazansky, members of the committee, I'm glad that it was your words and not mine for oversight. I've learned in my many years in this building to never call legislative council action an oversight, but yeah.
We all try to do our best.
Appreciate that.
Sometimes things happen when you look at the size of a bill like this, 37 pages, not to mention how many other bills they're dealing with. Some things happen, but we're here to correct it, and there's no big deal on that. Ms. Stratton, did you have anything that you wanted to add?
Just here to answer questions if you have
right. Any questions for this panel? Thank you all very much. All right, my next panel is going to be, I believe, Chris Kaut, Debbie Byfield, and I'm going to have Scott Winkle please come up.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities. I don't have a lot to add after your two previous excellent panels. However, I would like to state on the record that it's the official position of the League of Oregon Cities that Oregon's tort cap ought to provide just compensation for those injured by governmental actions, but still not jeopardize the ability of that local body, that public body, to provide meet the needs of its citizens. Based on that position, we're pleased to support the agreement that's outlined in Senate Bill 311. And with that, I would be happy to respond to your questions.
Chair Pruzanski, members of the committee, I'm Chris Kautz. I'm the Deputy Director from the Department of Administrative Services, and with me today is Debbie Fifield, the state's risk manager. The state of Oregon, through the Department of Administrative Services in the executive branch, is very supportive of Senate Bill 311 as it relates to the tort claim limits for state government. We did appear before the task force and talked through the issues surrounding the uncertainty that the Clark case brought and the certainty that this bill brings back to what tort cap limits would be for the state of Oregon. And that has also allowed us, through the governor's recommended budget process, to include the appropriate risk charges and have assumed that this bill would pass because it does create certainty for the system. So with that, I'm going to limit my comments because otherwise we're supportive. So thank you.
Ms. Fifield, did you have any comments that you wanted to add?
No.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions? Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. This is a question for Das. If you have done any assessment of how this affects the state potentially, and I saw that there was one of the previous panels had looked at, done a comparison with Vancouver, Washington, since they don't have an Oregon, a state Tort Claims Act, and they saw a differential about 30%. And I'm just curious, from the existing law to the proposed changes, I know it's you can only estimate, but have you done any analysis on that you can share with the committee?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dingfelder, we did have our actuaries work with us as the Clark decision came out, as well as through the task force work in looking at what potentially the new limits would be. As I was stating, the uncertainty that came out of the Clark case would have actually required the state to look at some additional surcharges on our risk premiums to charge state agencies because there was this uncertainty about the tort limits. Although I don't believe they were ruled unconstitutional, there was certainly a question that was raised. So the actuaries have gone through and taken a look at this. We certainly agree that there's risk into the future because we don't know claim volume, awards, or anything like that. But we certainly will be able to provide that information if the limits are changed to take a look forward. The actuaries, as you know, use historical losses and risks to determine costs. So that's a little hard to do at this time.
All right, thank you.
Thank you all very much. The last person I have currently signed up is Marion Haynes.
Good morning, Chair Pruzanski, members of the committee. My name is Marion Haynes, and I'm the Vice President of Legislative Affairs for the Oregon Business Association. OBA mission is to advocate for the long-term enhancement of Oregon's business environment and quality of life, providing statewide business leadership to ensure Oregon's long-term prosperity. Our members were very concerned with the elimination of the cap following the case against OHSU. We would like to commend the Oregon Tort Claims Act Interim Task Force for the excellent work they did to deal with this important issue, and appreciate the work that OHSU and the trial lawyers put into this as well. We believe this is a critical issue because of the impacts we've heard to state and local entity budgets, and believe that it also needs to strike a balance with reasonable and fair recovery damages to claimants that may have been injured, and we think Senate Bill 311 does that, so we'd like to add our support.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here today that wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 311? Not seeing anyone, I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 311, and we'll open a public hearing on, we're going to go in order, Senate Bill 305. And as soon as we get the sign up sheet, we'll commence. Yeah, and Council, why don't you go ahead and give us the summary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 305 is one of the ancillary issues that the task force tackled when we were raising the Tort Claims Act. We had some caps. We had some other issues that were raised, particularly by local government. This one, Senate Bill 305, allows a public body to waive an agent's right of indemnification by contract if the public body requires that the agent have insurance coverage required under the Oregon Tort Claims Act limits. Liability to the public body is only reduced to the extent the insurance is payable to the claimant, and allows assignment of the indemnification rights under the Oregon Tort Claims Act as long as the liability and damages issues have been decided prior to the judgment of the indemnification claim, and the public body is not bound by any claim of admission or amount of damages made by the assigner or the assignee, and allows assignment of the indemnification rights. This does have a dash 2 amendment, and it deletes the part where the public body requires the waiver of indemnification by contract with another body if there is adequate insurance. This came about because of the Welker case we discussed in the task force, and we have people to talk about it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative McPherson, did you have other comments to make on
the floor? Sure, I really made my introductory remarks.
I just want to make sure, since you're signed up. The first panel is going to be Mr. Blair, Mr. Snyder, and Mr. Lane. And gentlemen, for the record, as you know, please restate your name, even though you previously have been testimony.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, I'm Bill Blair, Senior Assistant County Counsel for Washington County, and a member of the task force. You have written comments from me. These particular amendments were and have been referred to as ancillary, and that is true. However, in our way of looking at things, these are inextricably tied to the limits as they are being raised. Because any increase in the exposure of state and local government also raises the impact of what we've called the ancillary problems. Under current law, let me just simply give you quickly an overview of the Welker case. The Teacher Standards and Practices Commission hired a private investigator or an investigator to do a study or investigation of a school administrator in one of our counties here in Oregon. And part of the contract with that private individual said you are to make no public disclosure or keep confidential your conclusions until they have been approved and with the consent of the school board. Notwithstanding that, the investigator disclosed certain information that Mr. Welker, the school administrator, felt defamed him. He brought a lawsuit against the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission and the investigator. The investigator asked for indemnity and defense under ORS 3285. That was denied by the state on the basis that he was acting outside the course and scope of his duties or had been malfeasant in office by violating an express provision in his contract. Mr. Welker, in turn, then the investigator, who was not Mr. Welker, agreed with the plaintiff in a settlement agreement that every dollar the plaintiff claimed was in fact owed and he was liable for it, and then in satisfaction of that admission assigned his right to recovery of indemnity and defense of indemnity to the plaintiff, Mr. Welker, who then sued the state not on the question of the underlying liability but rather on the assigned right of indemnity. And if that seems rather complicated, what it meant in practice was that the state would be without the opportunity of challenging the amount that it would owe to Mr. Welker if, in fact, the court found that he was acting in the course and scope of his duties. For procedural reasons, that case did not get resolved in the Oregon Supreme Court. But it points out two important things that are corrected in this bill. Number one is it makes it clear that we can, as a public entity, enter into a contract under which a contracted agent waives a right to indemnity. And it also makes it clear that if the agent chooses to follow the Welker path and assign that right of indemnity in a particular case, the public entity that hired him has the right to challenge not only the right, their denial of indemnity, but also challenge or make certain the amount of damages that the plaintiff would be ultimately entitled to. This is a bill that has, I believe, one issue that has resulted in some question, and that is, what about the self-insured contractor? In other words, if Washington County were to contract with a very large company to do something or other, and that company is self-insured, under the technical language of this bill, we would not be able to pass the risk by contract along to the contractor. We'd still have to hold on to it because we're not requiring that they buy insurance. They are self-insured. That is a fairly small issue, but one that I think can be easily corrected, and I think is one of the issues that ought not to derail the progress of this particular piece of legislation. So with that, if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Right. Who's going next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and we support Senate Bill 305 under the reasons that Mr. Blair has described.
Right, thank you. Mr. Lane.
Thank you, Chair Pazanski, members of the committee. Again, Richard Lane, member of the Tort Claims Task Force. Regarding Senate Bill 305, a couple of observations in the discussions of the task force that seem to be omitted from Senate Bill 305. Regarding Section 8, Sub B, there's a complete bar to the amount of damages ever binding the governmental entity. If you look at page 2 of the November 17, 2008 recommendations of the task force, there was language in the conceptual directions for drafting that the governmental entity would be bound if the damages were established by adjudication by a trier of fact. And this was something that we discussed extensively on this assignment issue. And that is that if there is some sort of tribunal that actually rules on the amount of damages and the governmental entity is bound. The other observation I would make is we had conversations regarding a case called Vaughn, and that is a case involving the city of the Port of Portland and a private independent contractor providing bus services at the port, claiming an entitlement to both the protections, the notice provisions, and the limitations of a governmental entity. And there was discussions about making it clear that nothing in here extended further any of the rights or protections inside the Oregon Tort Claims Act to pure independent contractors hired by a governmental entity to provide services. We'd request that be covered if the chair and the committee members are so inclined. I think those were the observations on 305.
Questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. The next panel that I have will be Fifield. I think that's it that we have listed on this.
My name is Deborah Fifield. I'm the state risk manager, and with me is Chris Kautz, the deputy director of DAS, Department of Administrative Services. We will be presenting the DAS testimony on Senate Bill 305. DAS does have concerns about the bill as introduced. We understand from discussions that have taken place outside hearings that one of the intents of this bill is to provide clear language in the statutes regarding issues raised in the Welker case. Through our conversations with Department of Justice, we understand that there may be the need to reassess and perhaps rework some of the language, and we have a representative of Department of Justice available to comment on that. From a risk management perspective, we also have concerns about the restriction of the state from requiring adequate and appropriate insurance from agents and the limitation to require statutory limits. I've provided some very detailed information on risk management process, which I can go through if you like, but in the interest of brevity, I will skip over that and just say as a matter of summary that the optimum risk management approach to contractual risk transfer involves assessment first, identification of all the risk management issues, and then selection of the most appropriate risk management treatment, one of which may be non-insurance transfer of risk. So we feel that this is severely prescriptive and prohibitive of appropriate risk management practice. We do stand ready to work with the drafters of the bill, DOJ, local governments, and other stakeholders to develop mutually agreeable language.
All right, thank you. Okay. Any questions for this panel?
Just a quick one, Mr. Chair.
Quick one, yeah.
The same objections apply with the amendment as well, since there is an amendment to the bill. So I didn't know if the amendment addressed any of the concerns that you had listed. Sorry. If the amendment addressed any of the concerns that you had listed.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, no, it does not address the concerns.
Okay. So let me tell you where we're going to go if you're finished.
I'm done.
All right. What I want to do is do a subcommittee, or let's say a little work group. I could call it that instead of a subcommittee. And at this point, based on the input that I've had, I'm going to ask Mr. Blair if you'd be so kind to be part of that group. DAS can be there. And then, Mr. Lane, I know that you raised a couple of things. I'm not sure if you want to participate in this or not. And you do. All right. So we have a work group on that. And thank you very much. Let me ask if there's anyone else that wanted to testify today on Senate Bill 305. All right. If not, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 305. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 302. And Council, why don't you go ahead and give us the overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 302 is another ancillary issue, and it came about because of the thought that was mentioned by Co-Chair McPherson that there might be incentive for the state to contract with local governments to use the lower caps that are available now to local governments with the Senate Bill 311. So that's what this bill was about. There was an amendment to it. I think there are also some concerns about this bill.
All right. My first group is going to be Mr. Lane and Mr. Blair. And I'll tell you what, and Das, I'm not sure if one of you two want to come up, then we'll just have a panel of three. Mr. Lane's punting on this one, so we'll take him off the list. Are you afraid you're going to get on another work group or what? The chair does not mean to intimidate on this. Bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members of the committee, again, I'm Bill Blair,
County Council for Washington County. You, again, have written, pardon me, written testimony from me on this particular bill. It is
ancillary in the sense that if, I
don't want to say I'm speaking for Mr. Lane, but I think I'm echoing the concerns that he raised during the task force, that if both both the state and a local public body are sued in connection with a tort claim, and it's because the state has contracted with the local public body to do something that the state would otherwise be doing itself, is the local public body an agent of the state? And if so, what Tort Claim Act limits apply? If it's not an agent of the state, what Tort Claim Act limits apply? And this all results from a what I will call a confusion, or at least a evolving uncertainty in the law of agency in Oregon, particularly as it relates to public entities and who is the agent of a public entity. Because of that, the task force wrestled with and made a recommendation to the effect that where the local public entity is acting in effect as the agent of the state because we're doing something the state would otherwise have to do itself, that the big limits apply and the state ought to be the principal and therefore under the substitute remedy of the proper defendant. In so doing, the language that you see before you is not the language that anybody specifically suggested to the task force, but I believe it does seek to accomplish that goal that the task force had. In that, this particular language kind of blasts away the distinction of agency and simply says if a local body is doing something under contract to the state that the state would otherwise have to do, then the local public body is the agent of the state. Not surprisingly, that I believe creates a certain amount of heartburn in the Department of Administrative Services and perhaps the Department of Justice. And I've indicated, I've had some kind conversations with Ms. Katz and certainly ready to work to come to some other resolution of this particular issue other than perhaps the language in front of you.
Great, thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Chris Kautz from the Department of Administrative Services. Mr. Blair adequately addressed our issue, which is we do feel that it does pretty much put the state on the hook for any and all services that are performed under an intergovernmental agreement that we would have with the county. And we don't believe that that was the intent. We hope it's not the intent because we like to work with those, with our partners on determination of risk and responsibility as we take a look at those services to be performed and those types of things. we would stand willing to work with Mr. Blair and others to refine the language a little bit.
All right, that's fine with me, too. Let me ask if there's any questions. Ms. Byfield, did you have anything else that you want to add?
No, I did not.
Any questions? All right, thank you. And so why don't we just have a kind of a dual work group on 305 and 302, and Mr. Lane can only, let's say, obligate it for the 305 discussion, so if you can work on the scheduling for Mr. Lane on that. All right, thank you all very much. Is there anyone else here that wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 302? If not, then I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 302. And I think we need to just take care of some housekeeping matters regarding this afternoon for those who are going to be going on the field trip to the Department of Corrections. My understanding, we're meeting up front, I believe, at 12:30. And I know some of the members are going to be traveling separately because we have to come back for hearings at 3 o'clock. And also for those who may be attending the trip down to the girls' facility in Albany tomorrow, I believe that is the same location at 8 o'clock. And so if everyone can make sure they're on time so everyone can get off and all that, that would be great. Is there anything else that we need to cover that or anything else? So we will be in adjournment with the this was on the notice that we are having two field trips in the next this afternoon and tomorrow, and then we're scheduled to meet next Monday. And Courtney, I hate to put you on the spot. Do you have a time? Are we starting at 8:30?
Yes.
I think it's 8:30. If you'll check your schedule.
It's 8:30.
Thank you very much, and we're concluded for today.